Hello, and once again, I'm delighted to go around the world and say good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to all of our global audience. It's 7 a.m. in Washington, D.C., 12 noon in London, 8 p.m. in Singapore and Manila, 9 p.m. in Tokyo. This LSE Ideas public event is on the topic of U.S.-China relations, increasingly volatile, blowing hot and cold, mostly hot in recent times, which may or may not change with US presidential elections. But our specific focus today is on what it means for the rest of us, those in East Asia in particular, who are inextricably linked to both the giants. A quick housekeeping note before we start: this event is being recorded, and the recording will likely be posted online. Also, we'd like to make this an interactive conversation, so please engage with the Q&A button on Zoom and ask some questions. Now, we're delighted and privileged to be joined by this panel for at least two reasons. Not only are they distinguished in their own right, they bring a diversity of perspectives that should allow us to explore this subject from many different angles. Japan, Philippines, or ASEAN, Singapore, defense, trade, investment, all of that. And I will introduce them just before they speak. So let me start with Professor Kotaro Tamura. Kotaro Tamura is a former senator and parliamentary secretary for economic policy in Japan. I think the first time I met him, he was explaining the policies of the Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, or Abenomics, to an international audience. He's now an adjunct professor at the Lee Kuan Yew School of Public Policy in Singapore and an Asia Fellow at Milken Institute, and a senior advisor to the China-Europe International Business School in Shanghai. A fun fact: the latest of his more than 10 books has been made into a TV drama in Japan. Professor Tamura, welcome, and thank you for joining us. And please, could we have your opening remarks, please?
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to join this fantastic panel. So I basically touch upon two points. One is products that will be brought about from the seemingly increasingly contentious rivalry between two giants. And then I will touch upon what Japan is doing and hopefully Japan will do in the future. So one is that, I would rather focus on the positivity and the bright side of the products made by this competition between two titans. Of course, there are so many concerns and the negativities, and that will be covered by much more intelligent fellows and my friends speaking after myself. So, competition is sometimes and always doing good and bad. And that reminds me the fact that, the kind of a very traditional rhetoric Sputnik effect that came through the huge, intense competition between former Soviet Union and the US on the space project. So this time around, I can say to some extent that will happen in more extensive way. From not only space technologies, but also AI, supercomputing, quantum computing, and food production, renewable energy, battery technologies, and the medical technology, and so on. So both big superpowers have enough hinterland population and enough scientists and enough level of the economic economic scale and also technological development stage. So they will invest almost all resources they have into the technological race between the two. And that will be deployed to many ways into the societies, because it's good for business, it's good for competition, it's good for economic development for further of their countries. And that will be also applicable to the countries, I mean, the rest of the Asia, to convince the rest of the Asia to join their side. So taking a side is difficult for rest of Asia, but at the same time, convincing rest of Asia to join their side is also not easy task for them to achieve. So I think beauty of Asian countries, including Japan, Japan is also sitting in the middle of the two titans. Very difficult way. Like many other countries, China is already the largest trade partner. At the same time, US is the most important security allies for Japan. So it's very difficult to take one side, but Japan is joining in many ways to US side. But at the same time, new administration is very pro-business and very forward looking to do more for the inbound tourism. So China is very important in many ways. But the beauty of Asian nations is not saying black and white very clearly. So we are obscure. We are between yes and no. So we can have a wisdom to reflect yes and no into many ways. So I think Asian countries will be benefiting to implement those technologies refined through the competition of two titans, such as AI, supercomputers, robotics, automation, food technologies, and renewable energy technologies and medical technologies. And not only technologies, but also infrastructure building and enhancing connectivity. So those two titans will rise in those space as well. And Japan is, in this respect, doing along with US, and we are announcing free and open Indo-Pacific corridor. And the other side is mentioning about One Belt, One Road. So we are ready, both are ready to do more for the infrastructure development of the rest of the Asia and enhancing connectivity physically and digitally. So saying not clearly yes and no, Asian countries also will be benefited from both sides and intensifying competition between two countries will benefit, as I have mentioned, technological development wise and also infrastructure enhancement and improving digital and physical connectivity of rest of Asia. So Asian countries will be benefited through two titans battle over two big space, technological development and also infrastructure building. Yeah, there's many challenges and the negativities and concerns coming from the race between two titans that seems like only intensifying regardless of which administration will be taking over US side. So that's my points. And what Japan is do and will do is that Japan is taking a balancing mediator play between the two countries. And Japan is in under the Trump administration, Japan is do a lot. US is American first. China is not respecting IPs. So we are mediating, saying respect more IPs to China. And the American first, forget about the American first, coming back to the international platform. So we are balancing that. And we do actually a lot, including TPP 11. And today is the inauguration of the ASEAN summit. And probably RCEP will be agreed. And this is the first free trade agreement done between China, South Korea and Japan. And 30-40% of the trade and 30-40% of the global GDP will be covered to some extent by this agreement. This is for the first time. And Japan is big. We can call Japan as a, upper medium-sized power. So Japan is number five in firepower, number three in the economic power. So we are ready to do more, trade-wise. And militarily, we are helping surrounding nations like Philippines, providing, radar system to Philippines and, providing many infrastructure that's not necessarily directly connected to the military, but, enhancing the connectivity and infrastructure for the economic development. So Japan will do more, although our resources is limited because of the shrinking, aging population. But we still have a deep pocket, the budget for international relations and the trade, and enhancing international securities is relatively small than compared to the Japan's social security burdens. So I will get him. How many minutes do I have?
You can take a couple of minutes to wrap up if you'd like, and I'll come back to you in the next round.
So, Japan is in a position that we're not able to relocate ourselves. We need to stay home, and we want to keep safe distancing, social distancing to the seemingly unstoppable neighbor is just cutting into the boundary of social distancing. So we'll be having, some challenges and concerns. But at the same time, that concerns and the negativities will be covered, already shared by most of the panelists here and the audience here. But I want to touch upon, cover the bright side coming from the, intensifying race between two superpowers. And Japan is doing a lot, and Japan will do more for the rest of the Asia. So I'm sorry, disorganized manner, but this is my points. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Tamura-san. That's given us food for thought. Optimism, you seem to be optimistic that these are opponents and not enemies. And you're suggesting that the rest of Asia can remain ambiguous between yes and no, constructive ambiguity. And I love that safe distancing comment at the end. I'm sure we'll come back to you on some of these. A reminder to the audience to please start posting questions while the remarks are still fresh in our minds. Next, I'd like to welcome Mr. Cesar Purisima. Cesar Purisima was Finance Minister of the Philippines between 2010 and 2016. He's a founding member of the private equity platform, Eklas Capital, and is also an Asian Fellow of Milken Institute. Not surprisingly, he sits on the boards and advisory councils of several major organizations nationally and internationally. Cesar Purisima, over to you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Lutfi, and to my fellow panelists, good evening from Manila. Looking at the title of the panel, When Elephants Fight, reminds me of an African proverb that whether elephants fight or make love, the grass gets trampled. And I would be careful to rush to say that ASEAN is that grass that the elephants like the US and China trample on, because to say so means that ASEAN is just a passive victim and does not have any agency to shape its own destiny. I don't really agree with that statement, as I will explain later on in my remarks. Before I go on to that, I would like to, for those who are not as familiar with ASEAN, no? ASEAN is the agglomeration of 10 countries in Asia that used to be called the dominoes many, many years ago, that were about to fall to communism. But with the advent of peace in the region, as well as the opening up of trade, the region has become one of the fastest growing economically. In fact, it's now China's largest trading partner. The region has benefited a lot from globalization. Two-thirds of its trade is subject to free trade agreement. ASEAN's vision, when it was formed from an economic standpoint, is really to be the hub of Asia trade. And geographically, when you look at the map, it straddles right in the middle of what Trump refers to as the Indo-Pacific region. So ASEAN has free trade agreements with five of its dialogue partners. Its trade is almost equal to its GDP, you know? And it has a very favorable demography and is expected to continue to use trade and globalization as an engine for growth, together with tourism becoming a major engine for economic growth in the region. However, this conflict between China and US, unfortunately for the region, the region has become the venue for such conflict for several reasons. ASEAN straddles the South China Sea. It's right at the heart of the region. And that hosts several of the territorial disputes involving China and the other claimant states. And of course, involving the US, you have freedom of navigation issues, no? And broader geopolitical tensions in the Asia-Pacific theater. The region is also incorporated in China's Belt and Road Initiative from both the belt and the road side, the maritime road, the Silk Belt. The region obviously has been affected by the pandemic that has affected not just China and the region, but the rest of the world. No? And we are also at the middle of the trade and tech nationalism that's going on, the duel for supremacy between both countries. No? So we are a host and a venue. No? And we can easily be trampled like a grass if we do not focus on making sure that ASEAN is not just considered an events organizer, but really a player in this dialogue. Why did I say events organizer? Because ASEAN has these meetings several times a year among its members and its dialogue partners. But for it to shape the narrative and be a playmaker in this dispute, which is to its interest, it's important that ASEAN doesn't lose sight of its centrality, because it's very easy for the big powers to try and separate, and break into the different interests composing ASEAN. And this happened during the chairmanship of Cambodia, for example. And that is why I think it's a good time to remember that for ASEAN not to be trampled upon so that it can actually help shape its destiny, which is going to be crucial to its success, ASEAN centrality must be emphasized. Kotaro-san mentioned RCEP, that's about to be signed. I actually preferred RCEP over TPP because of ASEAN centrality. In RCEP, the whole of ASEAN is included, whereas in TPP, only four of our members were included and could have actually become a major friction had it become, had it been signed the way it was originally designed, including the US. No? Now, centrality is not the end goal. Centrality is about the process of making sure that in the discussions, ASEAN's is at the primary heart of ASEAN interests at the heart of the discussions, rather than the goal of making sure that all of us are in unanimity. No? That is why in the ASEAN Charter, they came up with a mechanism called the ASEAN minus X. No? That's to give allowance to for member countries to opt out and allow ASEAN to be able to proceed with several key initiatives without unanimity. You know? And this is crucial, and sometimes it's referred to as the ASEAN way. You know? Centrality will also allow ASEAN to play the role of being an intermediary, you know, among the, you know, the two key powers, the lead actors in this conflict. The challenge of ASEAN, though, is that unlike the EU, the ASEAN Secretariat is very weak. You know? So for this to really become a reality, we need to continue to strengthen the ASEAN Secretariat, and also try to and hope that similar to the original founders, the leaders during the founding of ASEAN, have leaders that can actually you know, speak in the global stage about the interests of ASEAN. I think this still has a long way to go before we can truly say that we've achieved that. But I think it's important that we embark on this journey. And to embark on this journey, we need to make sure that we continue to focus on integration, the three pillars of ASEAN integration, and to make sure that in dealing with the non-economic issues of the conflict between the US and China, that we break it up, you know, into its different components. So, for example, on dispute resolution, that one, I think ASEAN should not take the lead, but rather allow the claimant countries to work on it on a bilateral basis. But on tension management, that's where ASEAN can take the lead, you know, and hopefully work towards the, you know, agreement and implementation of the code of conduct, for example, in the South China Sea. And in the escalation also of tension, that's where ASEAN can play a role also. This is clearly, you know, like walking tightrope, because it is hard to decouple the security as well as the economic issues. The reality for ASEAN is, given our proximity to China and given the growth of the Chinese economy, especially coming out of the COVID crisis, China will continue to become our biggest economic partner. And yet, from a security standpoint, historically, the U.S. has been the partner of many major ASEAN states. The Philippines, in particular, is at the is a treaty ally of the U.S. Now, so for ASEAN not to be trampled upon in this fight, many things we have to. Not just be an event organizer, in summary, but we really need to be part of the dialogue and be a player maker, not be looked at as a peripheral issue. And this can be done by continuing to focus on ASEAN centrality and being smart about the decoupling of security and economic issues, as well as the breaking down the security issues into different components so that we can come up with pragmatic solutions to reduce the tension and come up with pathways that may be considered win-win by both sides
right.
In resolving some of the more ticklish issues. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Purisima. So in order for ASEAN to have agency, it's important that it's not picked apart, that it's seen as an integrated, coherent unit, is what I understand to be one of your messages. Now, a special welcome and a special word of gratitude from me to our next speaker, Dr. Lin Kwok. Dr. Kwok joins us from Washington, D.C., where it's very early in the morning, so I'm truly, truly grateful. Dr. Lin Kwok is a senior fellow, a Shangri-La Dialogue Senior Fellow at the International Institute for Strategic Studies. She co-edits the Asia-Pacific Regional Security Assessment, one of the Institute's signature publications. She's also a visiting professor at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service. And she sits on the World Economic Forum Global Future Council on Geopolitics and International Security. Dr. Kwok, could we have the benefit of your perspective, please?
Thank you so much, Lutfi, and thank you, LSE Ideas, for the invitation to speak here today. It's a real pleasure. As you mentioned, I'm teaching at Georgetown University at the School of Foreign Service this semester. I'm enjoying my time with the students very much, and I hope in the audience we also have many students and we will also have many questions from them. So thank you and a warm welcome to everyone. Coming back to the title of today's seminar, Cesar mentioned how, you know, this is an African proverb. It was also kind of co-opted by the first Prime Minister of Singapore. And he mentioned that as a small and open country, Singapore will always be vulnerable to what happens around us. So when elephants fight, the grass suffers, but when they make love, the grass suffers also. So I think the point he was trying to make was less that small countries do not have agency, but the fact that they are vulnerable in the face of the turbulence created by great power competition. And so I'd first like to address how that competition is affecting the smaller countries of ASEAN. And then after that, look at what Cesar Purisima mentioned about, like, how they are trying to create greater strategic options for themselves. So on the first point, I think as Kotaro-san mentioned earlier, ASEAN, in the case of Japan, ASEAN countries are trying to avoid having to make a choice between the United States and China. But I think the tensions between the two superpowers are fast narrowing the strategic options. And I think the clearest enunciation of how this is happening was set out by the Singapore Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong in a recent piece for the Foreign Affairs, which I urge anyone who hasn't read to read. So I think he highlights several points, and I'd like to really underscore a few of them. Some of these have been mentioned by previous speakers, but I'd just like to put them all together. So first of all, the position that ASEAN countries are placed in because of US-China competition puts them in an impossible bind, because the US has been and continues to be an essential security presence for the region. This role cannot be played by China for several reasons, not least because of tensions with several ASEAN states over both territorial and maritime disputes in the South China Sea. The US, moreover, continues to be the largest source of foreign direct investment for much of Asia, though China is fast catching up. China, on its part, on the other hand, is the largest trading power of many Asian countries, including all US allies in the region. It's been ASEAN's largest trading partner for over a decade now. It's also perceived as having the wind behind its economic sails. And I think that perception is greatly helping China in terms of swaying countries to take a position that might be more favorable to China. Now, in the face of this dilemma, ASEAN has sought to do several things, right? We saw last year in June or July, ASEAN issued an ASEAN outlook on the Indo-Pacific. Some took that to mean that ASEAN was throwing its weight behind the United States, because the Indo-Pacific terminology is something that this current U.S. administration, the Trump administration, has favored as a kind of pushback against China. And it's seeking to put together a like-minded group of allies and partners. However, if we look at the ASEAN outlook on the Indo-Pacific, it's a far more nuanced document than that. Although it adopts the Indo-Pacific terminology, it also references the importance of infrastructure development to the region. And that, I think, is a nod to China's Belt and Road Initiative. It also avoids mention of the quadrilateral security dialogue, which is considered the more muscular arm of the Indo-Pacific strategy. And China resents the quadrilateral security dialogue, or Quad as it's more commonly known. And so the ASEAN outlook on the Indo-Pacific focuses instead on the need to promote economic integration and connectivity. So it avoids any sort of military statement and focuses very much on economic integration and connectivity. Now, even the title of the ASEAN Outlook on the Indo-Pacific, that suggests a certain distancing from the document, because it's not ASEAN's Indo-Pacific strategy, it's ASEAN's outlook on the strategy. So I think that has been something that diplomats in the region have taken pains to highlight. But of course, you know, in the media sometimes, you know, likes to jump on not all media, of course, but sometimes, you know, we just look at the words Indo-Pacific and say, ah, there you go. It's clearly accepted by the region. No, I think the ASEAN Outlook on the Indo-Pacific was a very nuanced document, and I urge everyone, all the students in the audience at least, to read this. So that's on sort of like the dilemma that that ASEAN and ASEAN countries face and how it's broaching the subject. Beyond the ASEAN Outlook on the Indo-Pacific, Mr. Cesar Purisima mentioned earlier, you know, it's seeking to assert ASEAN centrality in order to create greater strategic space for itself. But of course, incantations of centrality are not going to make it so. And a key test, I believe, for the region will be whether or not it's able to deal with hotspots in the region, including the South China Sea. There's been talk about how negotiations of the code of conduct are continuing, and I think that's a positive sign. It's better that parties are speaking than not speaking at all. But I think few are that optimistic that a meaningful code of conduct will be concluded. In addition, I think there has been, unfortunately, no strong statement from ASEAN on the South China Sea. To date, I think we have only seen the Philippines, because it brought the case against China, as well as Indonesia.